Hello and welcome to another episode of Is This Just Fantasy, the podcast where every week two nerds get together to rate, read and review a fantasy novel. I'm your host, Geordie Bailey.
And I'm his friend who this week shamefully didn't finish the book, Duncan Nicol.
For shame, Duncan, for shame! How could you do this to us?
I feel bad. I've had so long to read Priory of the Orange Tree. Geordie first put this book forward nearly 2 months ago now. We delayed the original episode because neither of us had finished it. Geordie then finished it. I've had a further month knowing it was on the schedule, and I come to you today, I couldn't do it.
Duncan, I read this book during my summer holiday.
Oh, that feels bad. Come on, my Christmas one in like 3 weeks.
So that's basically, yeah, like half a year has basically passed since we were like, yeah, we're doing this one. And between us managing to finish it, or one of us managing to finish it. Ha ha. But to be fair, we are now equal. I didn't finish Jewel of Jewelry. You didn't finish Priory of the Orange Tree. And in terms of word count, you definitely have something in your favour. This is a monstrously long book.
It is indeed. This is a absolute doorstopper in the finest regard. It certainly has one thing going for it, which is that I think, having not finished it, it's often advertised as quite a standalone. You know, so you're not getting in for 10 of these to do your Wheel of Time. This is a one and done affair. Although there is another book in the series.
Yeah, and the reason that it is long is that it's basically a trilogy in one book. It's pretty obvious that, and a very common criticism I see of this book is, this book probably should have been a trilogy. And the fact of the matter is, no, it couldn't be a trilogy. The book as it is does not work if you split it up, because it's all about different characters being in different locations, and you're waiting for their stories to all interconnect, like, say, the end of Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell. That's one. You have all these different characters. They fuse together at the end. It's tied up in a nice little bow. If you stopped the story at any point along the way, it wouldn't make sense. It would be worse than it is.
I can certainly see that. And Geordie, do you know, before I absolutely lay myself bare on this book, let's just quickly go. Have you read anything else of interest you'd like to share?
So, yes, I have. It is relevant to what we're talking about. I've had a very unusual experience this past 2 weeks, Duncan.
What's happened?
I got into another little Elric kick. I finished reading, what was it, A Citadel of Forgotten Myths. I didn't like it, but it did lead me to go back, oh, but maybe if I go back to some of the older Moorcockian stuff, that'll be of interest to me. So I started to look into what did he write after Elric, and that led me to, like, was it White Wolf's Son, and like the book three of the big omnibus editions that released of his a couple of years back. And they didn't interest me in the slightest. But something very interesting happened when I typed in the title wrong, because I accidentally wrote Son of the White Wolf instead of White Wolf's Son. Duncan, do you have an idea about what I might have stumbled across?
Son of the White Wolf. Now, to be quite honest, as far as I'm aware, the term White Wolf, the moniker, is given to so many fantasy characters. I think Geralt gets called that, Jon Snow gets called that. I think, is there a character in the Legend universe, is it Dresnia?
Also, I don't know what you're talking about.
You know, with...
Oh, the Drenai series.
Drenai series, that's it.
I have no idea.
Nope, none of them. Okay, cool. What did you find?
I found a short story by Robert E. Howard.
No!
Yes, it's his version of Lawrence of Arabia, of all things. It's about... it's about this, like, American soldier who's joined up with Lawrence and his Arabs, and he's fighting against the Ottomans, and he has to rescue a famous German spy.
That's... Okay, firstly, being a famous spy must make your job very hard.
That's the best part of the whole story. She's just saying, like, you know my reputation. Everybody knows what a good spy I am. And they're like, they shouldn't know that. They shouldn't know that. What is wrong with you?
That's incredible. I love the idea of writing in pulp writers writing fiction around, you know, real historical and contemporary historical fiction figures as well.
Yeah, I mean, this was written like Lawrence of Arabia was still alive when that was written. That would only be less than 10 years after he was active in the war.
Gosh, that's incredible. Wow.
Yeah, that's literally like me writing a story about like set like based around real life soldiers in Afghanistan.
Don't worry, add to that. Was it any good?
It was quite racist, but it was interesting. It was, you know, like, it was a nice little insight into, like, an American writing of his time. Like, what do you think? Like, I've seen, like, the movie Lawrence of Arabia, and I've seen what they have to say about this period of time and about the Arab nations, about the fall of the Ottoman Empire. What does an American have to say about it? And it's very interesting the way this is like, wow, this genuinely just feels like this is just another pulp story to you. It doesn't matter the fact that it's based along real people. You're just going to use it to tell another Conan story.
That's really interesting, kind of. And but to be fair, though, there must be so much distance between these real events, like halfway around the world, you know, to a writer in a town in the middle of Texas. Like, what does it matter?
Well, there's that, but also there's an interesting thing there. Like, what does he think? Like, this is a dude writing about Islam in the 20s. Like, and this the idea he seems to have of them is like really bizarre. It's like he sprinkles in all this like these little phrases he knows, like, you know, like Allahu Akbar, for example. Like, he has characters say that, and it's like it's really interesting to see a phrase which is so coded by quite racist material in our modern day, like say 24 or Homeland, where this is quite a loaded phrase, to see the way you're using it. And to see the outrageously racist stuff you have in here, where it fused with a lot of, like, noble savage stuff.
Ooh. Okay. So...
I mean, what do you expect?
I mean, I take it then it was a historically interesting read, but maybe not something you're going to widely recommend.
Certainly not. No, certainly not. I could not recommend it. It's interesting in that way from a historical perspective, but I can't recommend it. Anyone who isn't a big fan of, like, 1920 pastiches, seek out.
Very well.
I spoke about that for way longer than I expected to, but I'll say one more thing, which is that following the same curve, I finally, now, I'll have to say listened to, because I listened to the audio dramatization of this as opposed to, like, an actual audiobook, but apparently they're really close, so I don't worry too much. I listened to The Knight of the Swords, the first Coram story by Michael Moorcock.
Oh, excellent. Do tell me what you think. I, although I'm a massive fan of Michael Moorcock's Elvic series, Hawkmoon is the only one of his other characters that I've read the series of. What's this called? The Runestaff series with Hawkmoon?
Yes, the Runestaff.
Yeah. Yeah, but what's Coram like?
I loved it so much. I think I might prefer it to Elric.
What?
Yeah, it's no. Just really good. It's so simple and direct and exciting and grounded. Like, it's just regular sword fights most of the time. There's barely any, like, magical bullshit going on for the most part.
Well, now you've basically sold me. I have the entire Coram series sat on my shelf. I've never got round to it yet. So that is thrilling to hear. Oh, we might
know what we're doing next year.
Fantastic. Right.
The only book trilogy to have been written within 72 hours.
Seriously?
Apparently. I don't have the exact figures in front of me, but yeah, he got super, super high. And he wrote a trilogy of books in like a 100-hour-long bender, basically.
Michael Moorcock is an author that famously did a lot. Must have been alongside Stephen King in the early years.
It's incredible that he's still alive. It's incredible.
I hope there's nothing... I don't know, I don't hope, but I really like him as a character, Michael Moorcock. he's a fascinating author. Right, that's amazing, Geordie. I hope we can get around to that next year. I'm just going to quickly throw out there, because I haven't actually finished this yet, but I have been reading it. I'm continuing to plug my way through the Witcher series. I'm reading content, and the books don't quite line up to the Netflix TV show. Obviously, that has a lot of controversy. It definitely dropped off after the seasons. But I'm reading the book that lines up roughly with season 3 of the show. And I'm really strongly feeling, I get why the fans were getting very irate at this TV show. A TV show which, by the way, even someone who hadn't read the books yet was going, ooh, what are you doing that? Where are we going? I had the first moments.
I never bothered to watch season 2. I said season 1. I was like, that was pretty good.
Yes.
Okay, bye-bye.
Season 1 is. Genuinely, if you're tiptoeing around The Witcher, season 1 is a great kind of intro because it actually gives you the premise for the series and some of the short stories as these episodic adventures brilliantly. And then you could actually watch season 1 of The Witcher. Not that you should, but you could watch season 1 of The Witcher TV show and then skip over the short stories and start reading the main book series if you wanted to. I wouldn't recommend it, but you could. Like, it is fairly loyal, it knows what it's about. But season 2 and 3, well, season 2 goes off on such a tangent from the books that I was talking to my partner about it. She's like, so does it adapt it loyally? And I'm like, well, there are individual scenes that are loyal, but none of them are in the right order or the right context. So they all mean something completely different.
That's good. That's good. That's what you want.
Yeah, that's what everyone wants when they see the book series adapted. But yeah, I'm pulling my way for The Witcher. Yeah, they're good. They're fun. We'll definitely talk about them in this podcast one day, probably sooner than later. Back to the Priory.
Yeah, so I'm glad you didn't finish reading The Witcher, because that would feel like a pretty major betrayal of the podcast if you had.
Well, I just went, actually, do you know what? I don't want the book you picked. I'm just going to read this other fantasy series. In fact, I'm going to read this massive, all the books. I bought them all in one on Kindle. It's like a single Kindle book. So it's just, I just flow to the next. Yeah, I know. It's very hard to find your place. Yes, Priory.
So, Dunk.
Oh, got to talk about this.
Because I finished this such a long time ago, as much as I've taken notes and I've been reviewing like synopses of the book to refresh myself before the episode started, I can't deny it. I do feel a little detached to what actually happens in the book, so I think it would be really great, Duncan, if you could start us off by telling us what is this book about, as far as you can tell. And before we do all that, actually, last time we checked in, you said you were about a third of the way
through. Yes.
Where are you now?
Definitely a quarter.
Duncan, you know a quarter is smaller than a third.
I'm aware.
Oh, wow. You really were overestimating.
I went back to it, forgot what was happening, so I kind of had to keep working my way backwards to be like, pick it up again.
So you unread the book. You sort of like took it out of your brain and shoved it back into the page.
Yeah, very effectively. But what I do know is that this book focuses on cultural differences. We have multiple point of view characters spread across the world of the book. The world is very much inspired by Japan as like the central culture we're following. Yes. There's an east, there's a west, there's a south. There might be a north. Don't remember them being talked about much.
Nope.
And each of the respective characters actually brings something very different. Like you said, you were sort of thinking like, well, when does this tie together? I never got that far. So one of our first characters, and in many respects, the most traditional fantasy book protagonist, they very much have the hero's journey, I'm going to go on vibe, is the character of Tani, who, at the start of the book, saves a sailor who's washed up on the shore, who's from the west, he's a stranger, and I think she helps him because if he's discovered the westerners aren't allowed here, they're only allowed in like specific areas, which I believe is somewhat inspired by real world history. Japan had an era of like closed borders. And Tani saves him, and this puts her in danger, and he's obviously in danger. And this is inconvenient for Tani because Tani wants to go and join the Dragon Rider School because it's a special school for special people, and Tani's going to go and be special.
That's right.
And that's great for her. And just to go over what I did know, find out about Tani, is that she is chosen to be a dragon rider and is paired with a dragon, and it's really cool and that's awesome. However, plot twist, I think this is where it was going, her saving the man is going to be discovered and she is going to get kicked out of school. I don't know if that's a plot twist, actually. Plot progression is actually more the statement. So it sets you up with
predictable outcome of what happens at the start of
Yeah, to be fair, the gun was loaded and then it went off later. Very direct. But it meant that we didn't actually get a special school. I was like, oh, we're going to do special person at special school. But not too much. We were already kind of moving past that at the point I left. So
that's clearly. Right. She graduates. She does it.
It's good. Next things up, we have the court.
In the West.
In the West. They have issues with dragons, I think. There's a queen. The queen Court. Doesn't want... Sabran?
Sabran, but yeah.
Sabran, close. Thank you. And she has, like, her... She doesn't want to marry. That's clear. I think she wants to live forever. She wants to... That's clearly her goal. She's like, I'm not having kids. Sod that noise. I'll just make myself immortal. I couldn't quite work out if this was, like, an Emperor Palpatine level move. Or... Okay. Just a genuine reaction to, you know, why should I be forced to have kids? Fair play. I understand.
All right.
And then in her court, you've got all of the, like, I'm going to call them handmaids. Don't know what they actually are. Or a group of women.
They're like chambermaids.
Chambermaids.
The chamber or something.
Exactly. Yeah. They're called around and they are all about the scheming, the gossiping, the courtly murdering. They're down with it. They're very fun. And we're following someone who I believe, is it Ead? Iad?
Iad.
Iad. Who is doing a lot of sneaking. And it's very sneaky. And
who is Iad? What's her deal? Where's she from?
Oh, she is the Priory of the... No, she's not... She's part of the Priory of the Orange Tree. This is where it comes in. They're a secret order of wizards who...
Yes.
Protecting the world from dragons?
Yes, good.
And there's something to do with the queen. There might be a prophecy involved, but they're basically, I think she's trying to protect the queen. There's a, if the queen dies, that's bad for our fighting dragon principles.
Yeah, kinda, yes. It's a bit more confusing than that.
Wow. That's the best you're getting out of me.
You've named two of our main characters. There's two more.
Yes, there are. You've got the fun guys. What are their names? Is it Loth?
Close, it's Loth.
Loth.
And what's his friend's name? I genuinely can't remember, and I can't find it anywhere online.
Neither can I.
He's, like, our best pal.
I don't know what his best friend's name is, but they're a blast to read about.
Are they? Did you enjoy that bit? I found it insufferable.
Well, I like their opening chapter. I like their introduction, at the very least. I like the fact that they're all like, we've been exiled. We must make the best of it. We're being sent here to die or be put out. It's all under the guise. They've not actually been exiled. Like, Loth seems to think he was getting too close, rising too fast, and now he's been given a bullshit job somewhere. And he's taking his buddy along. And to be brutally honest, they're the ones that I'm like, I feel like you are going to discover something that's going to be helpful to someone else. But I'm most confused about where you're going in this plot.
That was totally the same thing for me. I really struggled to follow their section because it felt the most split away from the rest. And to be totally honest, I really feel the whole section just is a total waste of pages. It's very boring. It all leads into stuff that, like, the author really wants you to be interested in. Like, the wider politics of the world outside of just the east-west divide. It's like this country which is ruled over by dragons and the dragons, what do they worship? Not the evil one, it's called the,
Is that the Nameless One? The big evil one?
The Nameless One, thank you, yes. They're followers of the Nameless One, who's like the draconic Satan analogue of this world.
So, Geordie, I need to then get off quite quickly what my introductory thoughts were. And because people are like, Duncan, how could you dare come to an opinion you didn't finish the book? And to be fair, I completely get that. I feel bad. I'm sure if... Maybe things are going a bit more smoothly. Like, there's a world where I could have finished it. This is not, by all accounts, even though I didn't finish it, the worst thing I feel like I've read for this podcast. That probably still is Shirelle Ajori or The Demon in Silver. Like, this is not down that level. I almost feel bad because I feel like if this had been broken into a trilogy, although you said clearly, you know, it couldn't have been, and I knew I had less to get through, I would have finished it. I feel there was a bit of playoff there. I think where it comes down to on this particular story, I think there's very little plot-wise that I felt wrong. I think I was being set up a very interesting fantasy land with good politics, interesting world building, cool backstories. My personal issue is that in the early goings of the book, and I didn't make it to the later goings, I failed to really make a connection with any of the POV characters in a way that I did, and I am just using this comparison because it's the most recent one we've read for the podcast, the characters in Red Country. Like, none of them was I rooting for or enjoying being with as much as Shy South in Red Country.
Sure.
Like, that just wasn't there. There was no one that I'm like, I see you fully as a human being, rather than I see you fully as a device to drive the larger plot. And that was a problem. But there's so many elements, by the way. I really wanted to love this book because I love to read about sort of the other cultures. I do love that bit of politics. This kind of maybe comes up wrong, but I really enjoyed the fact that, you know, there was quite a few LGBTQ plus characters in here. I'm like, brilliant, oh, yeah. Love the representation, this is amazing. But even when, from what I got up to, like, they were there, I was like, that was almost, and this is also kind of a good thing, like, you know, that seemed to be incidental. It wasn't like, there wasn't romance, I didn't feel passion. That's the thing, I felt, when I was reading this, I didn't feel the passion for the characters or the characters' passion wasn't put onto me. It's like I wasn't as interested in the world because the characters didn't feel that they were fascinated by it all in the same way. Apart from Tani and like going to Dragon Rider School, which I kind of got behind, but in a very like I've seen special person go to special school many, many times kind of way. So that's where it left me. It wasn't awful, but it failed. The hooks just didn't get into me.
Yeah. That's kind of it, man. Like, I that's pretty much similar to what I, my experience of the book. Like, I think that, the characters, like you mentioned, are quite flat in comparison to the better books we've read. Even something like, say, Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell. That's a very long book in which you don't really get to feel, like, in-depth inside the characters' heads in the way you do for a lot of them. You know, like, take a character like Mr. Norrell. Mr. Norrell doesn't seem to have an especially rich inner world. You're not made to feel like you're on his side ever. He's almost the villain of the story. He's not very likable at all. But the thing that makes that book work so well is that it's very tidy. You know, it's all very amusing, and just reading a given page is just enjoyable. It's quite easy to get through that book, despite the fact that it's very long, because it's just a nice experience. This book is far, far more arduous. It demands so much of you just to get through a chapter. Do you agree with me there?
Completely. This is a book I do a lot of reading late in the evening. You know, I finish, come home from work, I do all my jobs for the day, and then reading's where I sit down, and I get a bit of escapism. And this book, Geordie, like, sometimes, with a really good book, when we're doing, like, Joe Comedy's an example that's in my head, but even reading The Witcher series at the moment, gosh, 50, 60 pages, just flies by in an evening. This book, 10, 15, and I wasn't bored, I was tired. I was just like, oh, I don't have any more to give. Thank you. I've taken on all this information. I feel like I need to go away and digest it.
Now, that word, digestion, I actually think is really pertinent to this. I'm going to take you, Duncan, on my, as quick as I can make it, my summary of what this book is about. And bear in mind, this book is like 850 pages long, and it's quite dense. So, a long time ago, dragons were a real menace in the world. There are two types of dragons. There are worms, which are like typical European dragons, so they have legs and they have wings. And then you have Eastern dragons. These dragons are much more serpentine, and only some of them have wings. The worms are associated with fire. The dragons of the East are associated with water. Which is, you know, that's in line with their various mythologies. Those dragons are ancient enemies. However, the people of the West have forgotten or have never learned that the dragons of the East were kind of on their side. Whereas, because the West hates dragons, the people of the East hate the people of the West because they hate dragons. But also because dragons impart a sickness onto human beings called the Red Plague or something. And if you touch a dragon, you know, you can catch this disease and then it spreads throughout people. And yeah, and that's not good. So they close their borders because they're afraid of the plague. So that's why you have this big division between East and West. And the big question is, will the people of East and West be able to put aside their differences in order to unite to confront an upcoming force which no one can prove is actually going to happen? So it's about climate change.
It is it? Wow.
Kinda, you know, it's about divisions between people.
To be fair, I have argued extensively that the White Walkers in Game of Thrones represent climate change, so...
Yeah, obviously, obviously they do. Yeah, it's about a threat you can't prove is coming, but you have to unite to go to defend. You know what this book reminds me of most of all, to be honest? I keep coming back to it all the time when I think about it. It's the Expanse series. It reminds me so much of that. That's a series that's also steeped in lore and history. It's about... The formats are very similar. You have different characters spread over a huge area. They always come together by the end of the book. And then, you know, it's all about humanity uniting. Humanity is always at its strongest when it's coming together against a common foe.
But the main difference there is in The Expanse, those characters are my babies. And I don't like anyone hurting them. And I just want to wrap them in blankets because they're all... Fucking amazing.
That's right. You like the characters, and each book is kind of a neat little package, which you then wrap up and you keep going forward with. Like, you keep all the elements that happened, but it's always its own little envelope. And none of them are 800 pages long.
No, they get close. So they go up to like... you're right. They probably top out around 550.
Now, I gave you the background. The Nameless One was a big evil dragon. He's Satan. He's pretty much Satan. He's gone. He was defeated, supposedly, by a knight. His name was Sir Galadriel. Yeah, Sir Galadriel defeated the knight using his sword, Ascalon. And he did this to rescue a maiden. So it's using this imagery of the knight and the maiden and the dragon, St. George, blah, blah, blah. And he defeats the dragon. And it's buried away underground, and it's never to emerge again as long as his line rules.
What a way to stay in power. Overthrow me and the world will be destroyed.
Yes, so Queen Sabran, her lineage goes back to this knight who, like, founded a country based on the six virtues, who were the knights who followed this dude. Each of them represents a different virtue, like courage and honesty and blah, 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 blah. And that line has persisted forever. And for some reason, they are always born as a girl, and they all look really similar. Like, there's very, very little variance in appearance between mother and daughter. And no one knows why. It doesn't even really make sense according to their mythology, because, you know, they come from this important male figure, but all of them are women. So, and yeah, so it's only passed down in maternal lines. However, the Prior of the Orange Tree says, those people are heretics. They remember history wrong. It wasn't the knight who defeated the Nameless One, it was the maiden. She was she picked up the sword and she was fighting this dragon, which happened to be curled around an orange tree. And after she was being defeated by him, she ate of the orange tree and was given magical fire powers that allowed her to overcome and strike down, but not kill the Nameless One, driving him underground. They believe that the followers of the knight are heretics and they're liars, and their faith is built on a sham. But just to make sure, they send Iad to protect the queen Sabran, the ninth, because, just in case the prophecy is true, and if she does die of a nameless one will return, they might as well have someone there to protect her from assassins.
I don't want to draw like a real world comparison, but that is like following a rule from a different religion, just in case. It's like taking all the different religious rules, putting them in an Excel spreadsheet and being right, if I do obey all of this list, then I'm definitely going to be safe in the afterlife.
Yeah, for sure.
They're not have confidence.
I am a Buddhist. You know, I've followed the practice of Buddha my whole life. But just in case, let's keep an eye on the Pope. Let's make sure he's okay, you know?
Yeah.
The Nameless One is supposed to be returning. Worms are waking up, they're emerging, they're presenting a threat to the world. And Iyad is starting to have to reckon with, despite the fact she's loyal to the Priory of the Orange Tree, she's like, well, I also have spent like several years of my life protecting the Queen, and I've made friends with a bunch of people in her court, including Loth, who's been sent on this secret mission. Where do my loyalties lie? And that gets much more complicated for her when she begins to fall in love with Queen Sabran.
Okay, that's the direction we're heading in. Thank you for dropping a lot of backstory. I love the fact that just at the end there, you linked it into our characters.
Yeah, so, I'm maybe like an eighth of the way through my explanation now.
And are we actually going to start describing the events depicted within the time frame of the novel?
I really don't think that I can, because I think that would be the entire episode. And we learned quite early on in this podcast that that's not the most interesting way to tell this story. So I'm going to try and do this in the most condensed way possible. I'll quickly jump to a character that we have not mentioned up to this point, despite the fact he's one of the main characters. Nicolaes Roos. You know who that is, right, Dunk? He's the alchemist.
Oh, the alchemist bloke! Yeah, he had a section, maybe?
Yes.
What's his importance?
So, Nicolaes Roos is the guy who was supposed to make the Elixir of Immortality for Queen Sabran, which she wants because she doesn't want to have a child in order to continue her line. You know, the line must continue so that she, she doesn't have to have, so that, must continue so that the Nameless One doesn't come back. That's her duty. But she really doesn't want to get married and have children, so she'd rather just be immortal. But after it's proved that, you know, he can't make an Elixir of Immortality, she has him banished to the East, and he ends up in Psyche, Fantasy Japan, and he's very resentful about this, and he wants revenge. So he wants to be able to make his elixir, and then not give it to her. To just be like, haha, anyone can have this except for you. He's the guy who receives the Western Sailor, who's a diplomat, who's trying to unite East and West, given to him by Tane, so that they can unite East and West against the Nameless One. He okay. will, later in the story, use the fact that he knows that it was Tane who gave him this Western Sailor, who's subsequently been captured by the authorities and put to death, along with, like, Tane's childhood best friend, for, like, covering up his crimes. And then he will use this information to blackmail her in order to try and get her to share with him one of the scales from her dragon, the Great Naimathon.
Well, that's a good plan. Why does he want the scale?
He believes that if they have a scale, or it might not be a scale, it might be a pearl from the dragon, that could be used to create an elixir of immortality because they live so long.
I mean, solid. Do you know what, Joey? Can I ask? I know this is going off track again. So Tani and her dragon, Naimathon. How sure. did you feel about their relationship? Because
for the most part, it sucks.
Not Aragorn levels.
No, not Aragorn levels. And Aragorn is the exact right thing. Aragorn was written when Christopher Pellini was 17 years old. And the relationship between Aragorn and Saphira is 8 times better than the relationship between Tane and Naimathon. It's absurd that you could possibly fail to do this. Like, the relationship between Hiccup and Toothless, a character who cannot talk and is basically an animal, is so much better than this one.
Just before people write in and tell us, yes, we're aware in the books, Toothless can talk.
Yes, I can. Yes, I'm well aware. I really liked those books when I was a kid. I was extremely surprised by their reinterpretation of the characters when the movies came out.
But happily surprised.
Yeah, they're pretty good.
Yeah, really good. Live action's coming out next year. Yeah, not super excited.
That's a really stupid idea.
Yep. They were so perfect.
Okay.
And Toothless still looks genuinely identical.
It's literally the same character. It's actually, okay. When that trailer first came out, I was like, wow, this is some quite sophisticated AI images. If only you imagine if someone was stupid enough to actually make this.
It genuinely actually kind of says, like, if you're going to readapt this work, why do a live action of the film? Go back and like maybe give the novels another spin in a more traditional sense? I don't know. David Tennant does the audiobook and he's amazing.
That's nice. That's good. That's a good choice. Okay.
So, Priory.
Priory. So Tane, but before he can succeed in blackmailing Tane, the Great Naimathon is kidnapped somehow. But it happens kind of on the page. She gets ambushed and tied down by pirates, who then steal her from Psyche because dragon parts are really valuable and there's a trade for dragon flesh. But they also kidnap Nicolas. Because he was there, and then later find out that he might be useful because their leader, who's like a pirate queen, wants to use him to create for her an elixir of immortality using the fruit of the hawthorn tree, which is a like equivalent, different but equivalent to the orange tree which a priory is based around.
Right, a few questions here. Doesn't touching dragons make people sick?
Only Western dragons.
Okay, next question. Why are people so confident that an elixir of immortality is like a real thing? Has someone done it before? Or no. Has this guy just upsold himself in a disastrous way?
Oh, wait, sorry. I said no. There are legends of immortals. So there is a legend of a woman who ate from... I think the legend says she ate from the hawthorn tree and that gave her immortality.
Now, logic dictates that if you can't find this woman, she probably doesn't exist because she's immortal, so she'll still be around.
Okay, so at a certain point in this book, they will find a historical account that says that this specific woman does exist, and she's mentioned historical account, but she dies. She died in the Age of Terror, whatever it's called, like the big war between East and Western dragons. Okay, so eventually in the West, Iad falls in love with Sabran. They enter a secretive affair. This is after she has gotten married to the prince of a foreign land. They've consummated their relationship. She's become pregnant with a child. Then she's almost assassinated by a traitor from within her own ranks. And she's injured in such a way that her child dies and she can never have children again.
Very specific, but okay, that's...
Yeah.
That drives some interest.
Yes, and it means that her line is broken. This is all internal politicking from a character. Like, there's a character in this who's super shady. He's like the master of spies, and he's the one who sent away Loth. And he's so dark and evil and shady that you're like, yeah, he's obviously not the bad guy. You know, like, if you were a child, you would be convinced that this guy's the bad guy. It's not him, so obviously it can only be this one other character because she's the only other important person from, like, the Queen's Council. So, it's her, and guess what? It is.
Don't you love, in every sort of TV detective show, when the detective first shows up, there's always that one arsehole on the scene? You know, the family member who's like, why do you need to push around here? We don't need you, blah, blah, blah. Yeah. And you're like, why do you bother? It's obviously not them. It's like the equivalent of a Sherlock Holmes story when, like, Detective, what is it, Lestrade goes, I've got the murderer. And you're like, okay, well, that's one person who's innocent.
Yep, Sherlock, that's right. We can rule him out.
Just for once, I want that to be inverted. But anyway, just be like,
yeah,
oh,
Lestrade really got his man this time. All right, so where am I at? Yeah, so their affair is discovered and Iad has to run. She's accused of being a witch, which she is. So she flees back south. She returns home to... I can't remember the name of her country. Duncan, do you remember?
Not a clue.
She returns to the south. She rejoins the priory and she gets to eat of the fruit of the priory, the orange tree again, which renews her magical powers, which she had sort of run out of up to this point. More than that, she's rewarded by being made a red sister. No, not from Mark Lawrence's books, a different one.
Same principle, though.
Yeah. Kung Fu nuns. So, yeah, it's...
Nice.
Yeah. After that, she is given a quest, and I genuinely can't remember why this is given to her or whose decision it is, but she decides to start looking into a legend that surrounds... Okay, so the Age of Calamity, or whatever it was called, where East and West dragons were fighting, came to a very abrupt end when a comet appeared in the sky. This comet shoots over and all the dragons go to sleep, including the Eastern dragons. West and East both go to sleep. And no one knows why. And it turns out that this light in the sky is a part of a prophecy which someone hears at some point and is then given to Iyad, that says that these two things, fire and starlight, must be in balance. I think Nicolas Roos is actually the first person to bring this up.
Right. Can I ask, right, prophecies. Now, do you think, Geordie, that a prophecy, by making a prophecy, you're sealing the magic in, like, the prophecy itself is the magic spell that means this is going to happen? Or is the prophecy just, like, the clairvoyance, the prediction that if these cosmic powers align, XYZ will happen?
None of that. They are statements made by historians in the past describing situations that exist. So actually, that's not quite true. The religious one is pure bunk. It's not true in the slightest. The line of Sabran has nothing to do with the nameless one. Their religion's just incorrect.
Well,
the prophecy about fire and the starlight being in balance isn't really a prophecy at all. It's sort of treated as one. But actually, it's just saying, this is what we understand to be true, and in the future, it will still be true, so don't forget.
Fair. Good, I'm glad that's tidied up. I like that. I like the fact that it's just...
Duncan, did you hear about a character called the Witch of the Woods?
No.
You did. You should have done. Alright, so you know how Queen Sabran is afraid of the dark?
Yes.
Okay, so Queen Sabran is afraid of the dark because when she was a child, she would often have nightmares about the Witch of the Woods.
Oh, yes.
A folklore figure. Yeah, she's sort of Baba Yaga folklore figure that's like, oh, I'm going to come eat your children. Okay, so bear this in mind. It turns out she's still around. She's a real person, and she actually joined the Prior of the Orange Tree, like, sometime before, before Iyad's birth.
So is she immortal?
Yes.
Okay.
She's immortal because she ate of a tree. There are three trees, Duncan. It's the orange tree, there's a hawthorn tree. Oh, or is it the mulberry tree? They might be looking for the mulberry tree in the east. And I think she ate of the hawthorn tree first, which gave her immortality. But then she decided she's got to catch them all. So she went out and she ate of the orange tree to get more magical powers. And the hawthorn tree gives you powers of illusion. And the orange tree gives you power over fire.
All right. Nice.
And so then she subsequently made three magical items. She made a stone which has control over water, she made a stone which has control over fire, and she made an object out of both the substance of the stars and of fire. So obviously, you know, this is classic meteoric iron, like incorporated into mythology.
Yes. What?
Okay.
Is meteoric iron like a thing? Obviously, I know it can technically exist, but, like, why would it have any property that would make it any more interesting?
That's a good question. So, for one thing, meteoric iron is historical, and it is important. For example, in the Tomb of Tutankhamun, he had a sword made of meteoric iron.
Oh, well, that
and
is
they
cool.
Clearly recognized that as, like, hey, this is special. This came from up. There's also, like, important in... I'm not that familiar about this, but in Islam, there's like a field full of like white grey stones, and then it's just a black stone in the middle, and they're like, this is crazy. Why is this one so special? It's probably because it's a meteorite. But another thing that's really interesting is with, I don't think it's specifically with Inuit people, but it is with like indigenous people who live in the far north, like above the tundra line, because this is the only source of metal they have, and it's really easy to find lumps of black meteoric iron on white fields. So they had, this was their only source of metal for certain types of tools and instruments.
Oh, wow. Oh, you would look after that.
So yeah, a lot of cool stuff you can do with meteoric iron, but I also love it in fantasy stories where it's like, yeah, it's space, it's my space sword. So she makes a magical sword, which is subsequently called Ascalon. She raises, she finds this kid, Sir, what's his name, Galadhian? No, that's from Green Rider.
Charlie.
What?
Sorry. Yes, kid A.
He finds the kid who had subsequently found a religion about himself, and she gives him the sword Ascalon, which has the united power of star and fire, so it's very powerful. And she rears him as her child, but she's also in love with him. So when he rejects her, and he goes into the world, and he finds this maiden, and he falls in love with her, she's very jealous about this. And when she has, when their children have, she like disguises herself as the maiden subsequently so that she can have his child by deception, and then their children together are the royal line that leads to Sabran.
Oh, that's gross.
It is gross, and it's called gross within the text.
Good.
She's a bad guy. At a certain point, they say she's united with the Nameless One, and I went, is she? I mean, she is a bad guy, but is she actually on the side of Satan? I didn't really get that impression, but apparently she is.
All right, this is... Can I ask a quick question?
Maybe.
What's Tanny doing during all of this?
I'm so glad you asked that, Duncan. Okay, so you know how I said that Tane, like, was disgraced when her dragon was kidnapped and it was revealed that she helped a foreigner?
Yes.
Okay, so they banish her. They send her to, like, the Scholar Island, where they send the nerds. And instead of being a dragon knight, she's going to act as a scholar for the rest of her days, and she's extremely depressed.
Wait, so she breaks the law... loses them a dragon, and her banishment is to have another career that could have been someone else's first choice.
Yes, but that's because she was a dragon rider. She has certain privileges.
I see. Bit mean to the scholars, though. Our punishment is just your life.
Yeah, her best friend was literally supposed to have, like, this position. That's what she worked her whole life towards. Alright, so Tane is extremely depressed. And then one day, I don't remember how this happens. She has an injury, a cut in her side. And when the doctor goes to work on her, they cut her open. And they say, we found a rock inside you.
Like, so it'd been there the whole time.
Yes, yes. So, Duncan, you may remember at the start that Tanya was an orphan, right?
Oh, is this going to be like... She was a foundling baby, but don't worry. Instead of having, like, a special birthmark, her parents sewed a stone into her with, like,
yes,
the royal
yes.
signal.
Yes. See, it turns out that Tane is the direct descendant of a woman who ate of the mulberry tree and achieved immortality.
Sorry, just think to like Harry Potter, leave a letter, like, nah, we're not leaving a letter with the baby. Sod it. Just shove it inside him. So go back.
So
yeah,
she has the stone that controls water.
Right, that's the magic stone. So she has magic
water
powers.
That's the magic stone, and the woman who was immortal died of, like, injuries at some point, maybe being killed by a dragon.
That's false advertisement on immortality, but okay.
And just to make something clear, I think that Iad is also the direct descendant of someone important, but I can't remember who.
Okay, so they're all destined. There is like an old yes. adventure to beat the Nameless One, and all their descendants are coming back together to beat them again. That's,
exactly.
That's cool. I'm behind okay. that.
Okay. So, Iad gets this knowledge on the actual identity... Okay, she has... I've done this a bit of it. She has some information about the true nature of Sabran. So she knows that Sabran is, like, not essential to stop the Nameless One. But she does know the Nameless One's coming back. So she wants to go back and help Sabran. Okay, so Loth got poison. He got the plague on his secret mission, but he managed to get his way all the way down south until they fed him with orange juice from the orange tree, which cured his plague. But they keep him imprisoned because he's a heretic, he's an outsider, he knows too much of their mysteries. But when Iyad shows up again, they escape together with her talking hyena friend. They escape back north across the channel, and they get back in, and they discover that a coup has happened, and Sabran has been locked away by the traitor within her ranks. They storm back in, they overthrow the coup, and they put Sabran back in power, and they execute the dissidents. And then, as they're making plans as to how to stop the Nameless One, they're saying, okay, we're going to need unity between East and West, because we need to find the magic water stone to unite it with the magic fire stone, which I managed to get from the witch. No, I managed to get from the Priory, because with these powers combined, and Ascalon, which we need to find, we still need to find Ascalon, the sword, then we'll be able to defeat the Evil One. So, they say, so Loth, right? Loth, Iyad, and Loth's sister all sit down together and say, alright, people have been searching for the sword for literally 1,000 years. Where could it be? And I'm not joking about this. They say, you know, after the knight left the capital, legend says he went to our house. Like, literally our house that we live in. Loth and his sister say this. Maybe we should go there. So they go back to their house, and unfortunately, yes, it turns out that their family has always been the custodians of the location of this magic sword, and their dad knows where it is. But he has dementia.
Why did he pass it on before that happened? Why didn't he think, oh, my son's come of age? Like, is there a ceremony? Do you wait till your deathbed to say, listen, the special sword of legends?
Yes, you are supposed to pass it on when your son becomes head of your house. Loth is 30 years old. He could very much be the head of a house right now, but he has declined to take this mission. But he's not told him about this for some reason, which means that, yes, they are supposed to hand it down when they would hand it over, which is presumably when they're going to die, which means that over the past 1,000 years, no one in his family has ever died unexpectedly.
That's so risky. What a
Yes, and they don't tell the daughter, the second in command. They say, like, okay, yes, our son has been sent on a suicide mission. I should probably tell my daughter about this thing that cannot be forgotten. But so, they managed to use some clues from this conversation with a demented dad.
No, don't. I've been to National Trust properties in Britain, okay? You know how often these are, like, the richest people in England, the English aristocracy. And, like, there'll be a house that was built in, I don't know, the 1700s. And the family tree moves sideways, goes back up on itself, because people consistently don't have kids, or someone dies suddenly, falls off their horse, because, you know, or just, you know, pricks their finger on a thorn bush, and because penicillin's not a thing, they die. Choke at dinner. Yeah. No one's ever choked at dinner.
Never. Couldn't happen.
So, or does that all have
daughters?
They managed to figure out
the hidden location of the sword, and it turns out that you need to have one of the magic stones to find your way in. But fortunately, they already have one of those, so they're able to skip the fetch quest that would be required to get in.
Why did the hero seal the sword away? Why not just keep it in, like, a royal vault or
above
his bed?
Because his mum wanted it back.
So just keep handing it to a swordsman. Surely its best defense is in the hands of someone who can use it.
No, she's a master of illusions. She could easily get it. So locking it away is a smart idea. It's just a little contrived that they're able to find it at this point, and it hasn't been lost forever over the past 1,000 years. So the moment they rescue it, it turns out the evil witch was following them, and she immediately takes the sword back.
Oh, so it didn't work.
Yes, so, and now the Evil Witch has the sword that's required to defeat the Nameless One. And as long as she keeps hold of it, they cannot defeat the Nameless One.
Jordy, can I just ask, page count, where are we?
Oh, that's a good question. I'm going to say, so, the last part of this book is extremely fast. The book is 800 pages long. I say that, like, the climax begins around 620 pages. And all the interesting stuff happens within the last quarter. Okay, so they go back and they say, okay, so we can't win because we don't have either the Firestone or the Waterstone. No, we do, sorry, we had the Firestone, but we don't have the Waterstone, and we don't have Ascalon, the sword. So, we can't defeat the Nameless One. But don't worry, we're going to try anyway. Loth, you need to go east again. You're going to go as an envoy to try and talk to the people of the east from either Psyche or the Kingdom of Many Lakes, which is mentioned every so often. And for some reason, the narrator gave them American accents. Don't know why. Very Texan accents, in fact. Go east. Work with them. Yeah, so Loth's like, I don't want to have to leave again, but I will. He leaves, and Iyad is immediately assassinated.
Okay. Unfortunate.
One of her best friends in the world shows up with the most powerful poison in the world, shoots her in the chest with a crossbow, and she immediately drops into a coma and for some reason doesn't die.
Oh.
She's given this incredibly virulent poison, which could potentially save her, but the only thing which can save her is the fruit of the orange tree. So, Loth goes west. I think he actually does know that Iyad is in danger. I think I may have got that wrong. But he goes east to go and find these people and ask for their help. But his boat gets lost along the way, and in a huge storm, it happens to wash up at the island which Tane lives on. Tane seizes her chance. She's figured out how to use the Waterstone, so she steals aboard his ship whilst everyone is off the boat except for one guy and Loth. When he looks back and says, oh my god, someone's stealing my boat, he gets back on, and using her water powers, she's able to direct the tides to lead this thing exactly to where she needs to go. So at this point, Nicolay's ruse has managed to figure out the location of the mulberry tree because he believes he could use that to create an elixir of immortality, so he's taking the pirate queen there along with the dragon. For some reason, Tane knows where she has to go. I can't remember how, but I think it does make sense. So they all meet up at the same place together, and bear in mind that Nicolay's ruse spends about a third of this entire book on this boat going to this location, and Tane immediately catches up with him.
Okay.
Nicolay's is being... They discover a tree, but the tree is barren of fruit, so there's nothing for them to take. They're going to execute Nicolay's, and this one woman who likes him for some reason. But then Tane shows up, and she kicks everyone's butt with her water powers. She releases her dragon, who then flies away with her, Loth, and this one random sailor who happens to be there as well, so that he can translate between Loth and Tane. They drop them off in eastern Texas, like the place that is China, but in which they speak with Texan accents. And finally, Loth has to do the impossible. He has to do the thing which his entire book is about, uniting these disparate people who have these incredibly different beliefs, and it is extremely easy.
No.
It's so easy. Yes.
Right.
It's done in one conversation.
Do you remember, like, The Legacy of Orisha? I don't know, like, if you've forgotten it already.
Like, yes.
Remember how that was all about these factions and people hating each other, and then they just sort of united against a common enemy, like, immediately? Please tell me it wasn't that level.
Yes, but imagine if they didn't know that a common enemy existed. Like they said, the common enemy is returning. Satan's coming back. And they said, sure, that makes sense.
There's not one dissenting voice going, can we trust this Loth guy? Who is this Lothgar?
Well, the only person we have to convince is the Emperor.
Oh, well, that does make life easier, to be fair.
Yeah. And the Dragon Riders on Psyche, which is a different country from the land of Midimus.
Is that an argument that, really, having a single absolute monarchy is better for uniting the world? If we had just dictators ruling each country, then there's fewer people to get in agreement.
They do bring down the only group trying to replace the queen, but they were just trying to replace her with a different, you know, figurehead. So, at the end of the book, Sir Bran's like, maybe I should invent democracy, but I'll do that later.
Oh, that's nice. I'm glad that thought occurred to her.
Yeah. Okay, so, it's extremely easy to unite East and West. What, you thought it would be hard? Don't be stupid. That's not what this entire book was about.
You just need one nebulous existential threat. Tani has her dragon back.
Yeah, Tani has her dragon back. And for the first time, you're like, okay, it's actually nice if these two are back together. I can kind of feel something here. Loth says, you have to save Ead. Take your dragon. Fly to the south. They hate dragons there, so you might be in danger. You need to get one of the oranges and bring it to Tani. So, she immediately flies all the way across the world. They get shot down by members of the Priory, and the dragon is immediately severely injured again, and they arrest Tane and take her to the Priory, where Iad's basically adopted dad is like, yeah, I feel kind of bad that my daughter was assassinated, so I'm gonna let you go. And so she has now steal one of this holy relic, one of the oranges from the Priory, against all of these wizard ninja nuns. How's she going to do it? Well, coincidentally, they are attacked at the exact same time by a bunch of worms who distract the sisters long enough for Tane to steal one and then flee northwards. But she has to leave her dragon behind because she's injured and she won't recover in time for the climax of the book. Wink, wink, nudge, nudge. Of course you will. I literally knew this was going to happen hours and hours and hours and hours before.
To be fair, I do like a bit of the cavalry arrives. It is a fun trope.
You'd love this book, Duncan. The cavalry arrives like 3 times.
Well, maybe then it's worth it to me. Genuinely, actually, I was driving into work in the car, thinking over, you know, famous tropes. And I did basically conclude that, and then the cavalry arrives, is might be my favourite. It's just one of those ones that when you get that emotional lift, you're like, yes! Come on, King Theoden. Never lets me down. So maybe this is what I need. But go on.
Okay. She returns to the north. She enters the court of Sir Bran. She gives Ead the orange, so she wakes up. They become friends pretty quickly, all things considered. And then they all get in a fleet together and head east to meet in the middle of... They all head east to meet in the middle of the ocean called the Abyss, where the evil one is located. And they unite there to fight the evil one when he emerges. Now, in the meantime, the evil witch has joined the forces of the Nameless One, and she promises Nicolas Roos. She has Nicolas Roos kidnapped, and she has him. She's like, I will bring back your dead lover, which is the whole thing you've been obsessed over this entire book, and I'll bring him back to life for you if you kill Queen Sir Bran. Here, have an invisible knife.
I'm glad she has invisible knives. Got to keep a couple of them lying about.
So, it's they're not mentioned up to that point, but it does make some sense. She's a master of illusion. And so he shows up in the middle of the ocean in a little rowboat, and he's like, I'd like to talk to the queen, please. And he hates the queen. That's been his whole thing up to this point. And his mission is to stab her with an invisible knife, but he actually throws down the dagger and says, I'm not going to take my vengeance. I'm going to have a character arc. And at this point in the book, I'm like, oh my god, I'm so bored of Nicolas Roos chapters, but at least he did the right thing.
Can I
nice.
Just say, no one else knows that he throws it down to the ground, though, because it was invisible.
They do.
He just mimes it, just going, pick it up I'm not doing this.
Oh, an invisible knife.
And then he had to pick it up again. So someone could just step on that.
They take the invisible knife. Okay, so there's now a big climactic battle. All of Vivi's fleets unite in one place to fight the fire-breathing dragons in their wooden boats. Yeah. There's a big climactic fight where all of these worms, including the evil one second in command, all show up and they fight. And the nameless one emerges from the ocean and he's gigantic. He's like on Caligon the Black. He's unbelievably strong, but the Psyche Dragon Riders show up and they help bring down a lot of the worms. And there's a big showdown between Tane and the witch. And it's legitimately a pretty good sword fight. I enjoyed it a lot. For some reason, however, she is wielding
Ascalon.
The sword. Ascalon. Which is now occurring to me, it sounds a lot like Ancaligon. Anyway, she's wielding Ascalon. You know, the sword the good guys need to kill the evil.
You're telling me
one.
She didn't wrap a load of Why rocks around just... it and throw it in the sea?
Well, she probably wouldn't do that because she's very proud of her creation. But she could have just left it at home. She doesn't need a magic sword to kill Tane. She just needs to throw a big rock at her. So there's a big showdown, and Tane is a really good sword fighter, but she's not good enough. However, Sabran shows up to help distract her, and then Iyad manages to kill her with one of her invisible knives.
Good for her. Ah, she died to her own magic. Can I ask, in all these scenes, so like, Iyad and Sabran have a bit of a relationship going. Like, are they just...
Yeah, they're in love.
Okay, so are there moments... Is Iyad, when this fighting... Is she, like, more concerned for Sabran than anyone else? Does that flicker through her mind? Do we have moments where Tani is like...
I think that's...
Who's the queen? Are we friends?
She knows... She doesn't like any of the people. She's like, I don't like you people, but I have to work with you. That is present. It's not like people forget about this. I will say, like, she's a much better writer than to just have them forget this. The end of story, I hope I'm communicating to you, but it's extremely abrupt. You know, it's an 850-page book, and all of the action happens in the last 150 pages. It's really abrupt. I see people bring this up all the time, criticism of the book, when it manifests. But these characters aren't forgetting whose side they're on.
Good.
That's not that at all. Now, the ending of this book is very, it's very anime. It's very anime. It feels quite a lot like something like out of Attack on Titan, even down to the fact that, like, the enemies radiate a lot of heat. Like, they want to get close to the Nameless One, but he's so hot that, like, the Eastern Dragons, it dries out their scales and they can't even get close. But of course, as Tane's like, how do I get close? The cavalry arrives, the flight of Eastern Dragons shows up, and a person she did the exams with, who shows up and is like, you think I'd leave you behind? Of course we didn't forget that you're a dragon knight. You're one of us. And so they fly on this together to get to the evil one. And it's all about, yes, just get the hero close enough. And Nicolas Roos happens to tell them that, 1,000 years ago, the maiden of the orange tree scored one good hit against him, and guess what? He has a little patch of missing scales on his left breast.
Actually, his left breast.
Yes. I can't remember where it is, but it's on his chest. Yes, it's Smaug. It's literally, it's definitely in a hobbit, it's Smaug.
Of course it is. As he turns, he just see it, the little hole. Last moment.
So they fly in, and none of the Eastern Dragons get close. Tane is hurled from the back of the dragon she's riding on. She plummets 1,000 feet towards her death, but she's snatched out of the air by, guess it, yes, Naimathon. Of course, the second cavalry is here. She and Naimathon have legitimately quite a cool fight against the evil one, and they succeed in doing something. I can't remember what it is. I think she makes, like, the hole a little bigger. Like, she can't... Yeah, I think she might put, like, a crack in him or something. And she drops the sword. But it just so happens to land on a boat.
Oh, thank goodness for that.
Instead of into the abyss. And so... Iyad, as Tane gets like scorched almost to death by the heat of the Nameless One. She grabs the sword, and this giant dragon, using his telepathy, communicates to her like, "Oh, I will make you a lord amongst women if you follow me. Don't do anything to get in my way." And she, of course, she rejects this. She has a connection to them because of the Firestone, and she grabs the sword, and the dragon, who has fire that can, like, you know, she's the biggest dragon in the world, they can all breathe fire, he decides to not breathe fire on her, or on her boat, and set it on fire. He charges her, and she manages to run back and stab him through the heart with Ascalon. And, you know, she goes head-to-head, smashes into a dragon the size of a mountain, and she's fine. She doesn't get hurt by this.
As we all know, momentum is just not actually conserved. If you do a bigger damage
when you stab someone with a sword, you stop all momentum coming
immediately. It's just how it works. If you do more damage, it cancels out their momentum. Sorry, can I actually say, Tordy, that, like, that is a fault, and it's a nitpicky fault, and obviously, you know, it's not the end of the world, but I've rewatched Twilight this week. I actually remember us praising, was it Stephanie Myers? For getting the momentum correct, yeah, when Edward stops a car, because he's super strong, but he still gets knocked.
Yes,
I'm like,
did,
yes,
that's right.
You get it. It's official,
that is right.
Twilight's like, better than Priory.
And Bella bumps her head because even though he rescues her, he still moves extremely fast. Anyway, he's thrashing around in the ocean. They use the combined power of the fire and water stone to smother him in water and drown him. And he's dead. They killed him.
Skills. And the world is free. And the warring nations
the
can go back to warring.
There's a lot more peace between East and West, but the South isn't really over it yet. And so in the epilogue, which happens extremely quickly, Loth is basically like, everything's fine with me? Good. Nicolas Roos actually has the best epilogue. His is really interesting. I've breezed over all his personal baggage because he's my least favorite character by far. And I never really felt this intense emotion burning to the surface. But I did in the epilogue. You know, when he's coming to peace with his past, I was actually like, man, I really wish I'd enjoyed reading about you this much throughout the rest of the book, because this is really good stuff. He meets up with, like, his ex-lover's, his deceased lover's wife. He was having an affair with him. And, like, they come to peace, and she's like, well, you have a place in society now. Would you like to be my friend? I'm desperately lonely, and I think you can finally see that, right? And so that was nice.
What's like?
Yeah, Tane is just like, fine. She's like, I'm going home. Everything's great. I have a dragon.
Which is all you need, to be fair.
I'd be happy forever if I had a dragon friend.
And Sabran founds democracy, which is really convenient because she can't continue her line and no one would believe her royal heritage is important bullshit anyway now.
Okay, so that's the interesting and complicated bit about the end. So, Ead, a lot of the Priory died in that dragon attack. So they're like, Ead, we know you betrayed us multiple times, but would you like to come back and be the head prioress? Which is not out there. It feels appropriate. But actually what feels more appropriate is that Ead should say no, but she doesn't. Because the big conflict Ead has had through the story is the love between her and Sabran versus the duty she has to the Priory. And the Priory needs Ead but doesn't love her back. It like constantly asks too much of her, whereas Sabran only wants Ead to be Ead. So when she chooses the Priory over Sabran, it's genuinely quite sad and tragic and effective.
Well, that is sad to hear. It's just, I know that feeling when you get to the end of the story and the character doesn't make the decision so you want for them. And I know it can often be used to get that kind of bittersweet, oh, the day is safe, but not everyone got what they wanted. They were star-crossed lovers. It could never be. Do you feel that the world justifies that enough?
Well, it's almost like that. Except what Sabran says is like, okay, we found out a lot. Like, for example, my religion is fake. And that's really, that's a rough pill to swallow. And I don't think the general populace is ready for that yet. So I'm going to start drip feeding them the fact that our religion is wrong over the next 10 years. And then I'm going to resign. So, Iyad, if you're ready to wait 10 years for us to be together, I will wait for you.
Okay, a few quick points. Number one, I think that's a nice romantic gesture. Number two, the idea that she thinks she can turn her religion around in 10 years is fantastically optimistic.
Yes. Have you heard of my friend, Paul Muad'Dib? He might like to talk to you.
Oh, exactly.
Yeah. So I'm reading this, I think, yeah, holy war. That's what's happening. Holy war.
Exactly. Nothing more need be said.
I was really interested to see where this book would go next, and I checked, and the next book in this series is a prequel. So I said, well, fuck that.
Georgie, wow. I mean, that was a journey. Thank you for recounting it to us. I'll tell you now, now that I know the end, I won't be reading it, but thank you.
When you lay it out all like this, it feels messy because it's such a big book. You know, we've done episodes in the past that are just about you explaining something to me. Like, go back to our episode on our lore dump episode on Dark Forces. Is it Dark Forces?
Dark Empire.
That's just you explaining what happens to me. And I think it's pretty funny. But it's also quite short. It's like a couple of comic books. This is a lot longer. There's a lot more going on here. And when I began this explanation, I didn't want to do a whole big plot breakdown. I even said I wasn't going to do that, but that's what I found myself doing because I felt like I couldn't actually talk about the book in a way that was different from your approach to the book without explaining the stuff that happens and how I feel about it. So even though it's not a format I really wanted to, I felt like I kind of had to do it.
And it was very interesting listening to you explain it. And maybe, obviously this is your explanation, this might not be how the book is set up. But I really felt like, here's the lore, Duncan. Here's the lore dump.
Yes.
And I'm like, great, because that's all relevant. And now here's the last 200 pages of interesting things happening with the characters. And I'm like, what was the first three quarters, like just slowly drip feeding the lore as the pieces are slowly put into place?
Every single chapter has at least one scene of characters just talking about historical events. And I remember a certain point in my life where I thought that was really interesting. I actually wrote a book where basically I tried to do that. I just tried to have people give this immense sense that the world had a deep history, and they would talk about historical events and legends, not in a way that was meant to explain it to the audience in a way that was relevant, just to show that the world had depth. And I've thrown that story out and I've put it in the trash because that was a really bad approach.
It's interesting. Now, obviously, this is very personal taste as a reader, and I completely understand loads of people, and particularly in our genre of interest, in the fantasy genre, do not agree with me on this. But I, in general, don't care about lore. I care about characters. And I know you think world building's further down. I enjoy an interesting world that the characters inhabit, have interesting creatures, have the characters have to do interesting things, or have certain prejudices or personality traits based around the world that they live in. You know, I'm trying to think of a good example, but like sometimes I feel like The Expanse, you know, you get a vibe of like you've got characters in a ship from all different cultures, and that informs, you know, their approach to waste or what they think is important or how they like to interact, you know, in a busy room or whatever. That works. But lore, come on. It's like a DM that's not doing so well. He's like, here's my interesting backstory over, and like, I really appreciate that, but I'm here for the characters and the adventure at hand. Be there, but be in the back. So, Georgie, back to you.
No, you're totally right. And I want to make clear, as much as this book has a deep, 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 deep emphasis on history and lore, they are necessary to tell the story which, what's her name? Samantha Shannon wants to tell. I think, fundamentally, the story is so much simpler than the actual history that's needed to tell it. It really is the cart before the horse in that regard, but it's not a waste of time. Like, the information that's being given to you is important to tell the story that's on the page. The book shouldn't be 850 words long, not because it's indulgent and it's a waste of time. It's that the book needs to be better to justify being 850 pages.
Now, getting back to talking about 850 pages, it's about 295,000 words long, as Google is telling me. Just put that in perspective. Geordie, how long's Dune?
220,000?
Nope. Lower.
How long is it?
It is a mere 187. So a third less than Priory. And right. I feel that Dune is a book lacking in world building and backstory. Or plot.
Well, Dune is interesting because Dune has a very different approach. Dune just sort of tells you something once and then says, pay attention. If you didn't pay attention, you missed it. And this book doesn't have that problem because they'll say stuff over and over in different ways to make sure that you get it.
But is that the right approach? So would you just say, like, because this is my vibe. Obviously, I dropped off because I wasn't engaged because I felt like things weren't happening. I was being told a little much. It became quite difficult to digest these complex backstories. Not even that complex, but these backstories with characters who weren't on the page. We talk about like what Tani and Sabran's doing, and Iyad and Loth. But if you're going to tell me a lot about the backstory of the kid who became the knight, who met the maiden, like their story is a good chunk of the book, but they aren't given the same room to be full characters.
Well, they aren't even characters. Like, the kid who becomes a knight, he never appears in the story. He's just a historical figure.
But he's talked about a lot.
All the time.
That's the thing. So he sort of has a lot of page space for a character that...
Duncan, it's sort of like... What was that book you read recently? Harlequin?
Yeah.
Alright, imagine in that story that he's Jesus. He's a character that never features, but he's probably mentioned a lot, right? And even when people, like, aren't talking about him, he makes up a substance of what they're talking about.
I do see your comparison. I didn't super love that book either, but for different reasons. All right, Dordy. So, I think it's only fair, because you're the only one who finished the book, to give a recommendation. Dordy, do you recommend this book? And if so, who to?
Duncan, I dispute that. I think you are completely in line to give a feedback. Like, you've heard the entire extent of the book, so you're able to make a more informed decision about whether you will finish it. But the fact that you couldn't finish it is legitimate. Like, if I can't finish a season of a TV show because it sucks, of course I can give it a 1-star review.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Geordie, I find this really hard then. I'll give my review first. I didn't enjoy reading this book. I cannot say it technically falls down in any strong way compared to some of the other stuff we've done. But the problem is, it's like... I'm trying to think of a really good example here. Like, trash TV, reality TV... It is trash, it is bad, but it's easily digestible. So you can get your way through it. This is not trash TV. This is quite good. This is really thought through. But it's so hard to digest. I found it so challenging that it was effectively too hard for the reward that I was seeing. And when we are in a genre packed full of big series and epic ideas going around... I was just like, I don't want to give my time to this. I'm sure, though, plenty of people will feel differently. And I do recommend people giving it a go. If you pick up this book and you find that you are flicking through it and you are getting through a nice click, then there's probably something here for you. But if, like me, you pick this up and in like 150 pages, you are struggling to push forward, I don't think there's anything wrong in waving the white flag and going to read some of the many other fiction out there that can have big ideas, big worlds, big narratives, big characters, But just be an easier, funner read. It's a pastime at the end of the day. It shouldn't feel like work.
I often found myself was reading this just stopping in the middle of a chapter and just needing to have a little personal rant to myself about why stuff was being so slow and how it could be told otherwise, and then begrudgingly hitting play again because I do a podcast. If I didn't do a podcast, I would never have finished this book. Ever. But that being said, when I was reading the epilogue, and I was reading the bit about Nicolas Roos, and I was like, I'm finally enjoying you as a character, and it's in your last chapter, and that's really frustrating. I went to Goodreads, and I read through all the 5-star reviews, and a lot of them give it 5 stars because of the sense of history and world building. There was a frequent refrain about saying, let's have a look at all the different cultural motifs that appear in this. And, you know, to myself, I'm like, that's not impressive. It's not impressive to, like, make a mention to King Arthur in your story about fighting dragons. But there's nothing interesting about that. This is baby's first theme. However, occasionally people would post little quotes from it. And they said, isn't this quite beautiful? And I kept going through it and I kept thinking, yeah, that is a really good quote. That's really well written. Why didn't I stop and go, hey, that was really good? My initial thought was to blame the narrator for my book. I listened to the audiobook. I think that was a good call because there's no way I'd read the entire physical book of this. I'd get bored way too quickly. But boy howdy, she did a bad job. She constantly got really basic words wrong. And when I'm saying basic words, I mean there's a bit where two characters are about to get into a duel, and they said they stood across from each other and performed their bows. And I'm like, bows? I thought this duel was being fought with swords. Oh, you meant bows. You confused the word bow for the word bow. That's humiliating.
You gotta think in those moments, they have an editor. Someone listens to that back. It's not like we do it in one take, guys.
No, they do it in one take. And I have to say this, Duncan, like, a lot of audiobooks, they're not being done in a booth. They're being done in someone's flat in Soho. And I went to this actor's, like, personal website, and she says, I record this on a Blue Yeti, which is the same microphone that you're using, Duncan. And so, you know, your podcast, which we make in our bedrooms, is being done with the same level of quality as, you know, this professional New York Times best-selling book. Like, not a lot of effort has gone into this. Also, she couldn't say the word courtier. She kept saying courtiers, and that was really frustrating.
That is terrible and unfortunate. And does that make you now stop and think, oh dear God, all those character names. Perhaps we've done it wrong the whole episode.
You know, now I'm a bit stressed out. I've seen the way Tane is written, and I'm pretty sure that is correct. She's gotta have gotten that right, right?
I hope so. To be honest with you, you say that, and you say, like, the same quality we use. I know that's like a dig, maybe, to the production values on the audiobook. To me, that just sounds inspiring. I feel like I need to,
yeah,
you know, pull myself together and start my own, recording my own versions of public domain works. Duncan Nichols.
Duncan, you could do that. There are professional YouTubers with millions of subscribers who use Blue Yetis.
Good old Mike. Love it. Right.
It's a simple mic.
Simple plug and play, but effective. Right. We'll happily take
the point. The point is that I didn't really like this book, but I did like some of the climax, even though it was a bit silly. And I think this book could have been sillier. I think it could have taken itself less seriously. And I can't really recommend it. I wouldn't tell people not to read it. I really had a false impression of what this book was going to be. I had really high expectations for it, which were let down. Don't do that. Go into this thinking, this book might be okay. See if you like it, but I'm not going to tell you to race out and buy it. But I might try and read it again. Because, Duncan, the book is so confusing and slow. And I'm not going to use the word turgid because you've pointed out that that's my most insulting word, so I'm not going to use it now. But it's one step below that. It's hard to get through. But now that I know everything about the world, now that I can explain the religion to you, maybe it's good. Maybe it will be more enjoyable.
Maybe. And that's a question for you to answer and then tell me so I can save myself from reading work like this again. No, Geordie, I can't take it. I need something lighter. I need something breezier. And as we head into the festive season, I want something with good old Father Christmas in it. Santa Claus to our international audience.
So Duncan and I, we said in our first year of doing this podcast, we're going to do one Christmas special because there's only one Christmas fantasy novel. And then last year we said, well, how about this one? This is kind of Christmassy, Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. And then we said, that's it. That's the last one, because we're out now. There are none left.
We were so wrong. Doing, like, a deep search, and to be fair, we've probably done the best. But there is so much Christmas-related fantasy works out there that...
They look pretty crap.
Oh, yes. They look awful. And we were lined up for so long to do something truly that looked truly appalling, and maybe it wouldn't be, and maybe we're about to discover a hidden gem, but at the last minute I ended up reading, and I have read this book already, a book that I wasn't expecting to enjoy nearly as much as I did, a book that kind of grabbed me with a really beautiful and popping colours on its cover, and a book that, to my great surprise and very minor spoilers, has a Father Christmas in it, so it counts, so we can do it, and I can't wait to share this. I actually think this novel is going to be a really good counterpoint to Prior of the Orange Tree. So we're going to be reading for our Christmas season the Korean bestseller by Mia Lee, apologies for the pronunciation, we're going to be reading the Delegat Dream Department Store.
Duncan, I can confidently say I've never heard of this.
I can confidently say, I think you're going to thank me for introducing you to it. Maybe. Oh, I don't know, actually. That was a bit too powerful. I mean, I'm going to roll back on that one.
He's really put his faith behind this one, folks.
Well, there we are.
Okay, well, I have no expectations for this, so I have no idea what's going to happen. This will be a really good time for me to make you read Scholomance, right? Because you failed to finish this book, so, I do get a destiny point.
You do indeed, Geordie. And if you plan to use it in the new year, I will continue Scholomance. But for the meantime...
A destiny point for all of our listeners is a point that we can accrue if one of us fails to finish a book. I think it used to be delays the release of an episode, but I think, to be honest, that happens so regularly now that it really defeats the point. Life is complicated, folks.
But... if you have read The Priory of the Orange Tree and want to tell us your opinions on it, maybe you grossly disagreed with our thoughts, or maybe you're very annoyed at the fact that I did not finish the book, the best place to vent is on our Instagram, It's a Fantasy Podcast. You can also contact us on our Gmail, itsafantasypodcast@gmail.com. Please don't rate this episode any lower because I didn't finish it. I really tried. Just give us the normal 5 stars and move along. Thank you very much.
Yeah, that's right. Well, Duncan, I'm sure with it, this book you've picked, the Dream Department one, is going to be a much easier, breezier experience than reading Prior of the Orange Tree.
I'm sure it will be. But until next time, I've been your host, Duncan Nicol.
And I've been your other host, Geordie Bailey.
Bye!
So long.